From WHYY in Philadelphia, it's Animal Week on Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our Animal Week series concludes with the bright lights and big-top adventures of animal actors. Bill Briloni tells us about rescued dogs who barked big on Broadway. He's trained all kinds of animals for stage and screen, even sheep. Also, we find out where working primates go when they retire. Charles Siebert tells us about several retirement homes, like NASA's Space Chimp Home, where residents enjoy rooms with skylights and TVs. And we catch up with Robert Smigel, the creator of Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today is the fifth and final day of Animal Week on Fresh Air, and we're ending with a day devoted to animals in showbiz. We'll listen back to interviews with journalist Charles Siebert, who wrote a book about where Hollywood chimps go after they retire from TV and the movies, and with comedian Robert Smigel, creator and alter ego of the infamous talking canine puppet, Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. We'll also hear from, and start with, showbiz dog trainer Bill Berlone. His specialty is finding dogs and other animals and training them for roles on Broadway. He walks into animal shelters and walks out with stars. Among the scene stealers he can take credit for are the dog who originated the role of Sandy in the Broadway hit Annie, the Chihuahua and Bulldog in the Broadway adaptation of Legally Blonde, and the Lamb in the revival of Gypsy that starred Bernadette Peters. Bill Berlone also is an animal behavior consultant for the Humane Society of New York, and his book, Broadway Tales, that's Tales as spelled T-A-I-L-S, is now out in paperback. I spoke to Bill Berlone in 2008 when his book came out in hardback. Bill Berlone, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Let's talk about Annie, since that's how you started your career and your habit of using shelter dogs. How did you back into this career as an animal trainer?
When I graduated from high school, I wanted to be an actor, and I lived near a very famous summer stock theater called the Goodspeed Opera House in East Haddam, Connecticut. And they're known for the reviving American musicals and introducing new musicals. And I volunteered there as a young kid to build scenery for free to be around real actors, professional actors. And my second season there as a set-building apprentice, they were doing a new show, and I remember being called into the producer's office, and he offered me a chance to be in Actors Equity, which is the Actors Union, and at part on stage, and I was bowled over. I thought he recognized my acting abilities by the way I'd moved scenery for 2 years. And the second part of the equation in my euphoria was, all you have to do is find and train a dog for us for the new show. And I left his office accepting the offer, and it took me like a day or two to realize that what I had agreed to, the new show was Annie, and they couldn't afford a professional dog trainer, and everybody on the paid staff had threatened to quit if they had to do it, so he was looking for a sucker. So I was that wide-eyed kid who'd said, sure, I could try anything. Someone said, oh, well, they have cheap dogs at the dog pound. Well, being 19 years old, I had never been to a dog pound, so I took the truck and a Polaroid camera and went casting. And I remember being profoundly moved. I had had dogs growing up. I was a dog lover, and profoundly moved by the situation of these animals in cages, who many of which were slated to be euthanized. And, well, I did find the original Sandy the day before he was going to be put to sleep, and I paid $7 for him. And I trained him as I trained my other pets. You know, I knew they could do repetitive behaviors. You know, I knew they loved the people they worked with and lived with. So I thought if I could make the theater his home and the actors his family, he might do what we asked him to. And that positive reinforcement method of training was somewhat revolutionary. It was the first time that a dog had played a character on stage. Annie opened at the Goodspeed and bombed. It got terrible reviews. The producer said to me, what are you going to do with the dog? I said, well, I'm moving to New York City. If I'm going to be a starving actor, I might as well have a starving dog. And I enrolled at NYU. And in the fall of 1976, Mike Nichols' office called, the famous director. He said, we're producing Annie for Broadway with the original company. Would you be interested? And I said, a chance to work with Mike Nichols? Of course I'll be a dog trainer. And went into rehearsal. We opened at the Kennedy Center. And in April of 1977, at the age of 20, Annie became a hit and I became a famous animal trainer.
According to your book, the original Sandy got run over 2 weeks before opening night. And went on. I mean, it's one of the best trooper stories I've ever heard. And I was wondering if you embellished that at all.
Actually, I did. You know, I was actually kinder to the situation. I mean, because it was purely accidental. Just so our listeners know, you know, in that summer, we used to build scenery in a big barn, literally a big barn. And Sandy would come to the set with us every, or to the shop with us every day, and he would hang out, and then he would come to the theater with us every night while we were doing other shows. And as the opening night got closer, they started laying down the scenery they had built on the floor to paint it. Mm-hmm. And I was off doing something else in another part of the the shop, and he stepped on a piece of scenery that was wet. And so, you know, the painter said, well, we've got to move him to out back. So they took him and they tied him to a tree out back where there was some shade, but he decided to go under one of the delivery trucks to lay in the sand. And the delivery person came to take the truck, not thinking to look for the dog, and heard this squeal and accidentally ran him over. The accident dislocated his leg, and the vet we took him to thought it would take a month for him to heal, and he had to be rested. You know, and of course, the producer was noticeably upset. He, you know, it was like, now what are we going to do? We got to find another dog. You know, if this dog doesn't make the opening night, I'm firing everybody who was involved. And so all of a sudden, my colleagues' jobs were at risk. And, you know, we would never force an animal to perform. And as Sandy was so enamored by what his life had become, that he would get agitated when he didn't come to the shop or when he didn't come to the theater as we were looking for other dogs. And then, you know, the director, Martin Charnin, saw the bandages on his leg and said, let's use it. It's great. It'll you know.
I don't know if that's what we did. I don't know if that's cold or warm.
Oh, well, you know, he was able to walk on stage. And there's a behavior in Annie where at a certain point he jumps up and puts his paws on his shoulders. And we had... I told Andrea McCardle, who was the original Annie, not to do that cue and give him the hand signal. But at that moment, he did it anyways, which was just the
It must have been very powerful dramatically if people believed the injury.
But nobody in the audience knew about the injury. But certainly for all of us in that theater that night, it was like the power and the loyalty of animals was just, you know— right there in front of us. And I feel blessed to be in their company every day, you know, because they're creatures with the absence of malice. You know, all they want to do is please. And so it's a wonderful life to have and to see that sort of loyalty and compassion.
Was Annie the show for which you developed, I don't know whether it's called the Berlone drop or the Bologna drop?
Yes. Initially in Annie and Sandy meet, and then they're separated. And halfway through the first act, they wrote in a scene after the show had become successful before we went to Broadway where they wanted him wandering the streets of New York looking for her, and they needed him to sit center stage, look right, look left, and then exit. And dogs have very poor eyesight. They don't see clearly at, you know, 20 feet. And so while Sandy would come to me, I couldn't get him to stop center stage because he would come about 10 feet 5 feet to the wings where he could see me clearly, and then he'd see his hand signal and sit. So I needed to devise a way to get him to stop center stage. And so, you know, as I clumsily was rehearsing, I noticed that every time I dropped a treat, he would stop what he was doing and pick it up. And so the aha moment. Mm-hmm. So I thought if I could drop a piece of food. And so we tried treats, and then the tap dancers would step on them and they'd crunch all over the place. And being somewhat young and poor, about the only thing I had in my refrigerator in 1977 was bologna. So we thought, there you go, it'll stick right to the deck and tasty. And so that's somehow how that came up.
So the tap dancers had to dance over bologna?
Yes, yes. And if they got it on their foot, it wouldn't like crunch and fall into the tracks, you know. And it's one of those ironic twists that, you know, my last name is Berlone. So from the time I was in grade school, everybody called me Billy Bologna. And so it's probably the reason I went into show business, all that teasing. So to have a famous move named after me is a homage at this point.
You've said that the original Sandy acted in Annie for 7 years. Mm-hmm. What happened to that original Sandy after, you know, retirement from the stage?
After the dogs are done with their shows, whether they last one night or 7 years, they are mine forever. And he went into semi-retirement and, you know, and did appearances around the country. And then as he became older and frailer, you know, I took care of him until he passed away in his sleep. And it was just so moving to me. You know, he died when he was 16 years old. And what I thought was somewhat of a trivial addition to the entertainment field, they did an obituary for him in the New York Times with his picture. And it wasn't a joke. It was very serious, you know, because one of the things we had to do, and we continue to do, is raise awareness for the plight of homeless animals. And Sandy became that poster child. Mm-hmm. You know, he was really the first dog to, you know, become famous and say that he was from an animal shelter and not bred from a line of lassies or, you know, Benji's or something like that. So I was quite moved that the entertainment industry got it.
Broadway animal trainer Bill Berlone. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Continuing our final day of Animal Week on Fresh Air, let's get back to my 2008 interview with Broadway animal trainer Bill Berlone. His book, Broadway Tales, is now out in paperback. It's about his work rescuing dogs from shelters and training them for roles on stage and screen. How many dogs do you have at home?
What day is today? As of today, we have 20. And 15 to 20 seem to be my magic Broadway number. Today we have 20.
20. And you have a young daughter, don't you? So,
yes.
How does she relate to all of these animals?
I dedicate the opening of the book to my wife and my daughter. And, you know, I believe having an animal in a child's life is very important because it teaches them altruism. It teaches them that they're not the center of the universe, that there are other creatures that need care and respect. If I give nothing else to my daughter, she seems to be very well centered in that, you know, she lives with creatures she has to help, she has to interact with, she has to share her home with, she has to share this world with. And so there are times where if she becomes forgetful and doesn't pick up her toys or stuff, they get destroyed. So there are many valuable lessons to be learned by having animals. And certainly, you know, in her 10 years, she's probably seen 10 or 12 creatures that she's lived in love with passed away. So, I mean, many issues we talk about. And so I think she's okay.
What pets did you have as a kid and what lessons did they teach you?
I had an unusual situation. My dad was a horticulturist for a municipality in Connecticut. So we lived on a farm that had greenhouses. I was an only child. And although we came from a big Italian family, my mom stayed home and took care of me, and I had a collie, a cat, and a rabbit, and we were in an isolated area in Connecticut, a rural area, so there were no kids around. So until I went to kindergarten, those were my companions, and when I did get to kindergarten, I was horribly shy. I didn't know how to interact with other kids because I had grown up with these animals. And so somewhere in that developmental phase, I must have learned how to communicate nonverbally with other creatures, which ultimately would come to serve me in my career. So, you know, it took me a while to, I was always shy and I was drawn to the stage because I could be part of the drama club, you know, and be the only boy with like 10 or 12 girls. And it was a good deal. I wasn't big enough to be a football player, but I could be on stage and people could listen to me and I didn't have to talk to people. So my development, both in being raised with these animals on a farm, I think led to my career.
In addition to Annie and Legally Blonde, the musical, in between are a couple of dozen other credits, stage and elsewhere. One that really surprised me. I would never have expected to find your name popping up associated with this. It's that famous Richard Avedon photo of Nastasha Kinski where she's naked except for a giant python wrapped around her body. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So where were you and why were you there?
When Annie opened on Broadway, Richard Avedon shot the characters from Annie for Vogue magazine. And I was 20 years old and went to the studio and for whatever reason, he was particularly impressed with this kid who had this dog. He got my number from the press agent, and he called me, and he said, I have this idea for a photo shoot with a snake. Do you train snakes? So I'm thinking, oh, my goodness, I've got a chance to work with this world-famous photographer. So sure, I train snakes. So what do we have to do? Well, we just have to drape it on a model. I said, okay. And he said, how much? And I'm thinking, do I have to pay him? until I realized he was asking me how much I would charge him. So back in 1977, I thought of the highest amount of money I could think of, which was $250. He went, okay. So I called a friend of mine at the ASPCA here in New York, and who was the exotic animal consultant, and she knew a snake guy in Brooklyn. So I called the snake guy. He said, sure, I got a boa. So I said, look, I'll split the fee with you. I'll give you $125. We'll work for an hour, easy money. Agreed. So day of the shoot, I never met him. We arrive at Mr. Avedon's studio, and this guy comes in with an ice cooler, and he's got sort of long hair and straggly beard, and he looks kind of rough around the edges. And Mr. Avedon comes in with Natasha, who's a teenager, wrapped in a blanket, and he said, we're going to drape the snake on her. And so it was a very sort of out of worldly experience for me. And she whispers something in his ear, and he comes over to me, and he goes, she doesn't feel comfortable with that gentleman. Do you mind handling the snake? And it was one of those defining moments where I went, oh, my God, I am terrified of snakes. So do I admit to this world-famous photographer that I'm afraid of snakes, or do I suck it up and do it? And I went, okay. So I go over, and the reason you put reptiles on ice is to lower their body temperature so they become less mobile. So I pick up this snake, and it is cold and, in my mind, slimy, but I pick it up, and I turn and look at the table, and there is a naked woman lying on it. Now, I'm 19 and a half years old. I had not seen many naked women in my life. So there I am with a snake in my hands and a naked woman in front of me, and I didn't know which frightened me more. Especially when I had to start draping it over her body near her private parts. I was a mess. But somehow I got them there, and we stepped back, and he started shooting. And after about 10 minutes, the snake warmed up, and we had to put it back on ice. Well, after 30 minutes, I was a seasoned snake handler. I was, like, all over this thing. And, the next thing I know, this becomes an iconic photograph that has been seen around the world.
In Gypsy, not the current Broadway revival, but the previous one with Bernadette Peters, you used a lamb. Mm-hmm. How do you train a lamb, and how often do you have to replace lambs?
In Gypsy, the family, the Havoc family, of which June Havoc and Gypsy were part of, and Mama Rose, loved animals. They were vaudevillians who had all sorts of animals, and so that was written into the script, their love of animals. And how and why a baby lamb was chosen, I'll never know. But, when Bernadette was leading this revival, she wanted me to work on it because she knew that I would make sure that the animals weren't ever hurt. And whether it's a baby pig or a baby lamb, you get these creatures when they're 5 to 7 days old because they grow so quickly. And when you're handling any infant creature of that age, you have to be very careful about their stress level, feeding, all that sort of stuff. And how do you train, those animals? Basically, the lamb had to be carried on and be quiet for a lullaby.
Mm-hmm. And be sung to.
And be sung to. And from having recently had a baby a few years before, I remembered, when I gave my daughter her bottle, there would be this milk buzz. There would be this euphoric, my belly's full with warm milk. I'll just lay here. And I thought, well, maybe that works for lambs too. And it does. It's amazing what a little warm milk will do for you. So each night before the lamb went on stage, we would give her, her formula. And she'd go on stage sucking her little lips, eyes half open, digesting her milk, and then 10 minutes later, she'd be up and awake and ready to play. So her feeding schedules were tied around the performances at the Schubert Theater every day. And they would last 21 days. By the time the lambs were 21 days old, we would be into the next lamb. I would go up to a farm in upstate New York, get a baby lamb, bring it back, wash it, diaper it, and we'd switch it out. And we ended up going through, I think, 23 or 24 lambs over the run of Gypsy.
Are lambs always available?
No. That was the other thing. I talked to one of the original stagehands who worked on the Ethel Merman production, and they used to go to the meat market. This was in the 1950s. Get baby lambs, use them, and then barbecue them after the show was out when they got too large, which in the 50s was an accepted practice for meat animals. Certainly, we weren't going to do that on the current production. So, and they only, lambs only have babies once a year, and it's in the spring. So I was not only charged with finding lambs all year round, but what do we do with them afterwards? And I found there is a farm, world famous farm, that produces sheep milk cheese. It's one of the gourmet places. It's in upstate New York, and it's all organic, and they artificially inseminate sheep all year round so that they're continually lactating, and they keep the female sheep and they send the boys to the meat market. So we went, I found this place, and they generously loaned me baby lambs because I would bring them back, you know, clean and healthy. So I could say to Bernadette and the theatrical community, if you want to see any of our lambs, go up to the farm, and they're grazing up on some beautiful fields.
Well, Bill Berlone, thanks very much for being here on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Animal trainer Bill Berlone. His book, Broadway Tales, is now out in paperback. Here's the song from the Broadway revival of Gypsy, which was sung to that lamb on stage. We'll have more guests with more animal stories in the second half of the show. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from LendingTree with the innovative Loan Coach, which provides personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process at LendingTree.com. From the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from doctors and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at angieslist.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a retirement home for chimps from the entertainment world. Michael Jackson's chimp Bubbles lived there. We'll talk with Charles Siebert, who wrote a book about it. Also, Robert Smigel, creator of Triumph the Insult comic dog, on why he thinks dogs are so funny. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our Fresh Air Animal Week continues with Terry's interview with journalist Charles Siebert, who wrote a book about where chimpanzee performers go when they're through acting in circuses, movies, TV shows, and commercials. A lot of them, it turns out, go to a kind of retirement home called the Center for Great Apes on the outskirts of Wachula in South Central Florida. Siebert's book is called The Wachula Woods Accord, Toward a New Understanding of Animals. Terry spoke with him in July.
Let's start with just a roll call of famous chimps living in retirement now.
Well, I guess we'd have to start with Bubbles, Michael Jackson's chimp, who lived in the very retirement home for chimp entertainers where I lived for a time. There's Cheetah, of course, of the Tarzan movies. He's out on a West Coast retirement home in Palm Springs, of course. There are all the chimps. Do you know the CareerBuilder.com commercials that were so popular during the Super Bowl, where one of the chimps, the chimps run amok in an office. They're all dressed in suits, and one of them pulls down his pants and sits on the office copy machine. All those chimps were at the Center for Great Apes, where Roger and Bubbles are. There's the orangutan from a movie called Dunstan Checks In, something with Jason Alexander, which I've never seen. Roger, my star of my book, he was a cellist in the in an all-chimp orchestra at Ringling Brothers. So it goes on and on. And when you visit this place, it's so ridiculous because you walk in and, you know, Patty Reagan, who owns it, will just introduce you to each of them. And, it's, you know, you're just looking at these stars with their dossiers. And of course, the sadness involved is that, as people don't realize, they have viability as actors for about 5 or 6 years. And then they get too big and strong and end up living 50 more years in captivity. So,
well, we'll get back to that in a second. But let me just ask you, does Roger, the former circus cellist, still play cello? Do the circus stars still do the things that they were trained to do?
That's funny you should say. Just the moment prior to meeting Roger and locking eyes with him for the first time, Patty was introducing me to these chimps in an enclosure opposite Roger's. And one of the chimps there is named Butch, and Butch came walking out of his back quarters towards the front of the enclosure in an eerily upright sort of position. And he came right up to the front, and Patty went, "And that's Butch." And I went, "Hi, Butch." And Patty put her hand over her mouth like, "Oh, no, you shouldn't have done that." And Butch immediately went into a classic stand-up ta-da pose with his hands straight in the air. And this was his old shtick, which was prompted that whenever anyone said hello to him.
Now, as you said, you know, chimpanzees can only work till a certain age, what, about 5 or 6? And then what happens?
Well, as we sometimes see in horrible circumstances with pet chimps, they get big and strong. An adult chimp is about 5 times stronger than the strongest human, and very rambunctious in their teenage years especially, just like human beings. So they become willful and very aggressive, and they are, after all, wild animals, all of our, you know, distortions of them notwithstanding. And because a lot of them have gone through traumas of captivity, being separated too early from their mothers, not growing up with other chimps, they have pathologies, they have neuroses, they have trauma. And sometimes the littlest thing, as with humans, can upset the scar tissue, the trauma in their brain, and set them off, as we saw with this incident in Stamford, Connecticut not too long ago, where Travis mauled that woman so horribly.
You know, when Michael Jackson gave away his chimp Bubbles, gave him to a sanctuary, he said that Bubbles had become too aggressive. But apparently that's the typical problem after a certain age for people or circuses or TV trainers with chimps.
Absolutely. I mean, when that Travis incident happened, I wrote a piece, an op-ed piece for the Times about it. I mean, it was literally a chapter out of my book because there are about any number of similar stories. People just, you know, we have this cartoonish notion of chimps. We know them in their baby stage when we dress them up in cute little suits and they pedal around on bicycles. And yet time and again, once they get too old, we hear these stories of Quincy Jones. I read the other day was remembering Bubbles and how Bubbles bit his own kid's hand when he visited Michael. I mean, these chimps can be very willful and aggressive.
Some of these chimps are research chimps, too. I mean, isn't there one facility you visited where there's all the NASA chimps, all the chimps who were the chimps in the space research are retired?
Most of them are research lab chimps for medical purposes, like finding cures for malaria or hepatitis, or they thought HIV. So the country bred an unbelievable number of chimps that when AIDS first broke out, thinking that they would be an obvious model for finding a vaccine, and it proved to be not true because it looks like AIDS morphed originally from a chimp simian virus. So we had all these surplus chimps. But yes, also chimps who were used in the space program way back and went through all those flight tests. And they ended up at this facility in Shreveport, outside of Shreveport, Louisiana. And this was the result of the Bill Clinton's last act in his presidency called the Chimp Act, where the government, rather than, you know, had all these surplus chimps, and they thought, Jesus, for, you know, for all the effort they've and sacrifice they've made for us, we can't just put down all these chimps. So we built a retirement home for them. And I must tell you, when I visited it, I was thinking, I don't think I'm going to do as well in retirement. We're talking very nice rooms with skylights and television sets. Television sets. Chimps love TV. They love very dramatic, violent shows. It should be no surprise. Nature shows. This one really got to me. They love soap operas, and their favorite is the research lab chimp's favorite is General Hospital, because they're so used to people in white coats. So it's just remarkable their level of sentience and awareness.
When you talk about chimps in retirement homes, I'm also picturing like chimps on walkers, but I guess not. No.
Well, it's getting pretty close. I mean, you know, this is why I was so envious. Right down the hall, they had their house dentist, they had doctor. You know, I mean, they have their little patios outside that then gives on to a fenced-in patch of forest where they swing. I mean, you know, it's the best we can do to extend the paradox of trying to dignify an animal in captivity, but it is pretty well done. I mean, they're still in captivity, but it's the best life we can afford them after all they've been through.
Well, particularly, like the research chimps, like we've used them for our own good. We've put them in harm's way for our own good, so we owe them a good retirement, which is going to be a lot longer than the life they spent doing the research.
Exactly, and a lot longer than a chimp would live in the wild, because you know, in the wild there are so many more threats to a chimp, whereas in captivity, you know, they're protected, so they live. Some of them live up to 60, 70 years old.
You ask a really kind of profound question in the book, which is, what does it mean now that we have this whole population of chimps who were raised in captivity, who lived around humans more than around other chimpanzees? They were taught to perform for humans or to do research for humans, and you can't return them to the wild because they never lived in the wild in the first place. They wouldn't know what to do there. It's kind of like me when I go camping, but worse. And so you can't return them to the wild. And so who are they? Are they humans? Are they chimpanzees? Or, as you put it, are they humansies? Like what are they now?
Yeah, they're stranded. They're being stranded between their former selves and what we've tried to coax them into being, or what we've been suggesting to them. And a lot of them stay stranded. They can't go back. I mean, Roger so captivated me among the chimps at that retirement home in Wachula, because at least when I met him, things have changed, but he was the only chimp there who lived alone, because whereas others began to learn to socialize with other chimps. By the way, zoos refuse to take these actor chimps because they're so asocial and clumsy and don't get along with other chimps at the beginning.
They get along with people, but not with other chimps.
Exactly. But Patty's been very successful in sort of re-socializing a lot of these chimps, so they make friends and at least have the company. But Roger was so adamant about his sort of his loneliness. He wanted to be with people, and it seemed to me that he wanted to be with me when I first got there. There was this very strong reaction that he had, as almost as though he recognized me from some prior encounter. But no, you're right. These beings can't be wild chimps again. But so they're just caught. They're forever stranded between what they were and what we suggest to them. So I call them humanzees or chumans or manpanzees, all these words for these hybrids that we've made.
Journalist Charles Siebert speaking with Terry Gross in July. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Feel the funk, y'all. Let it flow.
Let's get back to Terry's interview from July with journalist Charles Siebert. His recently published book about the retirement home for chimps is called The Wachula Woods Accord.
How do you think your encounters with whales and chimpanzees and other animals that you've written about over the years have affected your sense of what it means to be human?
I think it underscores my, I guess, my humanness. It seems like a contradiction, but I love being reminded of my animality and don't feel, as I think a lot of humans do, debased by that. But I feel deeply liberated by and ennobled by the reminders of my connectivity with all other biology and biological life forms. And, you know, and I'm going past even the ones that shock us with their incredible humanness, like the chimps or the elephants. I mean, I was so moved by that experience because, I mean, elephants like whales and we now know chimps. I mean, they have culture. We can now use that word. They have self-reflection. They have tool use. They wound. They have trauma. To know that there are, you know, it used to be the science told us we couldn't anthropomorphize. Now, of all things, science allows or at least obviates the sin of anthropomorphism, because the question isn't anymore, you know, oh, we can't know what a whale day is or a chimp day or a dolphin. You know, now we know through science that they have days, parallel days that are equally as intricate and woundable as our own days. And I don't know, it's wonderful to know that. One, it's the sense of, you know how we often ask that question, are we alone? And we ask that about extraterrestrials. Well, you know, when you meet a whale or an elephant eye to eye like that, you feel like you're making contact with another being, a foreign being, but another being, and you don't feel alone anymore. So we're, the very encounter we seek mythically and through fiction, you know, is available to us through these other very sophisticated animals.
Do you have pets?
Yeah, two dogs, and I've had dogs all along, yeah.
And
I spend a lot of my days talking nonsensically to my dog.
So do you feel a different sense of connection with your dogs than you do, say, with chimpanzees or with whales? Do the chimpanzees and whales seem more different from you, more far away than your dogs do? Or
I guess the encounter with the chimps and the elephants and the whales are more fraught because of the clear complexity going on behind those eyes. Whereas, you can be, as I was just alluding to, you can be sort of shameless with your dogs in terms of what you'll say and project upon them. Not that they're blank by any means, but clearly one knows that there's not as much going on the sort of neuronal level that there is with some of these other creatures. I mean, these brain studies that have been done now, this is what I meant about science liberating us to make conjectures about these creatures. I mean, when you look at a whale brain, as a scientist up at Mount Sinai School of Medicine has done, in a chimpanzee brain, and a dolphin, they're finding the exact same structures in the neocortex that we evolved in our own brain, and the very neurons that we used to say the cells that make us human. Well, now we found, for example, whales not only have more of those cells than we do, they developed them millions of years before we did in a whole different environment. So stuff like that just, I don't know, it just makes my head spin. It's just amazing.
In the acknowledgments to your book about chimpanzees, you thank a few doctors for saving your heart when sudden illness struck. May I ask what happened?
Yeah, about a year and a half ago, in the midst of trying to get this book finished, I was walking to a restaurant one night with my wife, and I found myself short of breath. And for no particular reason, I couldn't explain it. And I was sitting up at night sort of, you know, wheezing, and I just didn't know what was going on. And I went to a doctor and thought that it might be pneumonia. And it turned out that a virus had attacked my heart and reduced its function to a critically low level. So I was just really knocked for a loop there, and also had no health insurance. So the whole picture was not a pretty one. I was saved by a guardian angel that I mentioned, guardian angels that I mentioned in my acknowledgement, Neil Epstein, a cardiologist who I wrote about in my previous book, A Man After His Own Heart. I've long been obsessed with the heart because my father had an incurable kind of heart failure, thus the deep irony of someone who's been, you know, as obsessed with the heart and sometimes paranoid about the heart as myself to be felled by this virus. And I was given thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars of care because I was put in part of a research protocol at the NIH. And it literally saved my life, and my heart's rebounded since. And I'm on medication to help that process along. But it was the kind of nip and tuck there for a while. So,
you know how in some hospitals they have therapy animals that they bring in for the patients so patients can pet them, and it's supposed to kind of relieve stress and just be a generally all-around pleasant experience to spend a few minutes with an animal. Mm. Did you have animals in addition to your dogs to help you during your time of recovery, or were you supposed to stay away from animals because of possible infection?
Huh, interesting. That's one of the things I want to find out about in this, my pursuit of knowing that what happened with this virus. Was I infectious to other people? But to answer your question in the immediate, no, I didn't have, when I was at the NIH, I had no contact with animals. But, you know, it's funny you should say, to help me get past this, I also became suddenly diabetic out of nowhere, which is there's no history for in my family. So this, whatever this virus was, it knocked me, everything in my system for a loop. And I was having to inject myself with insulin, having to take these pills. And at one point I looked at my wife and, you know, I needed to finish this book. And I said, you know what? I just can't be here. I just can't be around you and be injecting myself. I needed to be alone. So I took my two dogs and this same heart doctor who saved my life offered me his cabin in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And I went and lived there in this remote cabin by myself with the two dogs. And it just helped me to overcome the whole setback physically and helped me to focus on the book and get it all done. But I have to say, those two dogs also saved my life because, you know, I had that companionship, which is, you know, invaluable.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Journalist Charles Siebert speaking to Terry Gross in July. His book about a retirement home for chimps is called The Wachula Woods Accord. Coming up, Robert Smigel, the creator and alter ego of Triumph the Insult Comic Dog, on what makes dogs, especially talking dogs, so funny. This is Fresh Air. To wrap up our special Animal Week, we're going to listen back to an interview Terry conducted with Robert Smigel. Smigel is best known as the voice and hand puppeteer of Triumph the Insult Comic Dog. But he also is the creator of the Fun with Real Audio and Ambiguously Gay Duo cartoons on Saturday Night Live, and the Animal Puppets or Annapals, who starred on Smigel's cult Comedy Central series, TV Funhouse. Terry spoke with Robert Smigel in the year 2000. They talked about why dogs were funny, and he told her about the inspiration for one of his puppets, a real dog named Zebu.
It was my wife's dog. He was a German Shepherd mix, and I believe part wolf. And they took him to obedience school, and after two sessions, the teacher said, you know what, he's a beautiful dog. And you should just enjoy him. He's beautiful. Take him home. He was that stupid. One of the reasons my wife and I get along so well is because we can both laugh for a half hour just watching a dog that stupid chase his tail, which is what we used to do. The dog had this incredible rage, it seemed, toward his tail. And there are a few things funnier than watching a really dumb animal passionately go after his tail. And then he had this way of of chasing it, and I guess I've seen this with other dogs, but not to this effect, where he would just, he could go 90 miles an hour in a circle and then just stop on a dime and completely freeze and then go 90 miles back on a dime, just like as if he was trying to, he didn't look like he was catching his breath. He actually looked like he thought he would trick his tail this way. You know, I'll turn and turn and turn and then stop. And the tail will have no idea what's going on. He'll be totally frozen, you know. And then, boom, I'm back at the tail. But it just, of course, it never worked.
So that's your voice that the dog does? I mean,
yeah, yeah. I'm basically, I have this stubborn insistence on making all the dogs sound like Eastern European immigrants. You know, and some of the, I've noticed that some people have criticized, you know, they've watched the show and they've said, why is he doing, why do all the dogs sound like Triumph, you know? Why do they have the same accent? It's like, it's lame. Can't he come up with another voice? And, well, yeah, I could, you know, I realize there are more accents in the world than Eastern European, but in my head, that's how dogs talk. They just, they have for years. Since I was 10 years old, I used to, you know, give dogs that voice when I would look at dogs. I think it's because my grandparents they're Russian immigrants, and I grew up with that voice, and I think I make an unconscious connection, and let me finish the thought because it could sound rude, but between dogs and immigrants just off the boat, because they both have a certain element of wide-eyed wonder that, as if to say, like, oh, look at all of this. I cannot believe this. And, you know, eventually European immigrants catch up and become jaded, but dogs never do. And that's why I can laugh at dogs forever.
One of the things I think you're doing on TV Funhouse with all your use of the Annapals, the puppet animals, is having them do the kind of things that animals really do in public, but that people only do behind closed doors, such as having sex, defecating.
Right.
I mean, I know, like, as a kid, there's things you learn that people don't do in front of other people, period.
Right.
But you see animals doing it all the time in the street.
That's right.
And it's very confusing sometimes as a kid. Like, how come they let animals do that in the street?
Yeah. I know. We can learn a lot from animals.
Well, that's the whole point of the books that your parents give you, so you can learn a lot from animals.
Right. And now this is an adult show that's trying to have animals teach people how to behave properly. No, there is something, you know, it's fun doing a show with that has characters that don't have the inhibitions that humans do. And that can talk casually about things like pooping on the street or having sex as if it's just a regular animal need, you know. I try to explain to people that when I write about sex or I write about defecation, you know, I'm going to look like an idiot saying this, trying to explain why I think this stuff is funny beyond, you know,
cheap crude laughs.
Cheap laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, it's all about the way our dignity is compromised. You know, sex has always cracked me up because it makes people do crazy things. You know, like working out. I mean, Jesus. Can you imagine? Anyway, But it, you know, that's the funniest thing about it, that we are, you know, I remember years ago we were at Saturday Night Live and I was hanging out with Conan O'Brien, who I met there as a writer, and Rob Lowe was hosting, and so everybody was passing around the Rob Lowe sex tape, and it was just, you know, something that you don't get to see that often, is just a real life porn like that. And, you know, just a lot of it was really boring. And, but all this fuss was being made over something that was, you know, quite common. And I don't know, it was just, I just remember Conan just laughing and just saying, we're just all animals. It's hilarious.
Did you have a lot of pets when you were a kid?
I had a cat when I was 4 years old. My parents gave me a cat, and the cat just sat on the foot of my bed and did nothing all day long, just grew, sort of developed that mashed potato body that, cats get, just sort of spread on the carpet as the years went by, but I just adored it. It had no interest in anything, but I just like, pretty kitty. Good. I just loved it. Loved it like nothing else. And then later on, after the cat died, my sister, who didn't really like the cat, suddenly, this is I've noticed this too, that like it's the sibling who didn't like the animal that suddenly is like, gets all emotional about the animal when it dies and wants to replace it immediately. And that's what happened. And then we got a little tiny Bichon, and all I could do all day was talk to the Bichon in its own voice. And it was very similar to Triumph's voice, just a higher pitch, you know, because it was such a froofy little thing. And it was just very spoiled. I want to eat now, please.
Did you talk to it a lot?
I used to drive my sister crazy. Just, you know, she would like walk into the room and I would say hi and the dog would run up to her and I would be like, hello, hello, I've waited all day for you. Where the hell have you been?
Robert Smigel speaking to Terry Gross in 2000. His TV Funhouse cult series has been released on DVD. And that concludes Animal Week here at Fresh Air. No animals were harmed in the making of this week's programs. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hersfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.
Support for NPR comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. From the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Take these chains from my heart and set me free.
John Doe, co-founder of the great punk band X, recently released a CD of classic country songs. On the Labor Day edition of Fresh Air, John Doe performs some of those songs in our studio. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Set me free. Take these tears from my eyes and let me see. Just a spark of